Perfect.
Okay, well, welcome everyone. And a bit of a follow-up to last week, first of all, just a minor little piece of interest, I guess. So how many of you are aware of the Book of Tobit? Tobit.
Yeah, but I'm
One or
really
two, yes. Okay, well, hopefully you're not, because it's in the Apocrypha. But just for a couple of minutes, last time we were in Samaria, and we met a woman with five husbands in the past, that is, and one who wasn't her husband now. And there's a very similar account in the Book of Tobit. Let's just admit one
Oh,
more.
sorry, I was busy
Yeah, it's all right.
muting
Now,
folk.
just let Maureen settle in, if she does. There we go. Right. Hello.
Hi.
Right. So, Tobit, of which we didn't worry too much about him, but the Book of Tobit apparently tells the story of Tobit, who's the son of Tobiah, or son of lots of other people. And he eventually marries, and he has a son called Tobias. I don't think they were very inventive with names then. And unfortunately, something awful happens to him, and he goes sort of blind, or partially blind, or temporarily blind for a little while. And then into the story comes someone called Sarah. And she has had the one with the unfortunate background. For I'm now reading from the third chapter of Tobit. Get it right, the third chapter of Tobit. And it says, on the same day, it also happened that Sarah was reproached by one of her father's maids, for she had been married to seven husbands, not five, but seven. And then it says the wicked demon Asmodeus had killed each of them before they had been with her, as is customary. In other words, basically before she'd had any children with them. So they had been killed off by this wicked spirit very very quickly, one after the other. And so the maid says to her, "You are the one who kills your husbands." Of course, it wasn't her personally. "But see, you have already been married to seven husbands and have not borne the name of a single one of them, not had a child at all with them. So go away, basically. Maybe never see you again, or son or daughter of you again." But anyway, she turns to the Lord, and there's lots of praying. And at the same time, Tobit, who remember was gone blind, he was also praying. And on the same day, Raphael, the angel, came to both of them, and Tobit's eyes were cleared again so that he could see. And Sarah, who obviously couldn't really get an eighth husband very easily, actually ended up marrying his son, Tobias. And so it all ended happily ever after. Anyway, that's just to point out that there in the strange book of Tobit, there was someone else who suffered even more than the Samaritan woman by having had and lost seven husbands all very quickly. Right, now today, let me just start off with a picture. It's not the most exciting picture, but let me share that picture with you. Can you see that?
Yep.
That obviously is walls, two of them. And it's meant to tell you about a place that we're going to go to called Jericho. So apparently that's the walls of Jericho, which I used to think was an Israeli ice cream company, but apparently it's actual walls like that. Two huge walls, very thick, with a gap between them, probably well, about 9 meters high. This is based upon what they've discovered from it and so on. 2 meters thick, or even 4 meters thick, different things is, and this big gap in between them. And we'll come back to why that might be interesting later. So anyway, we're going to Jericho, and if you've got a map, you can have a look at where Jericho is. But some of you might know that it's obviously pretty close to Jerusalem, and it's down towards the Dead Sea. So we're picking this up in Joshua chapter 2, because our character today is Rahab. So we've got another female character to look at. And we're going into Joshua chapter 2. Now, Jericho was a wonderful place. Even if you go there today, there's the old ruins, but there's also the more modern place. It's very lush. It's on a really good site. In those days, it was on the trade routes. It was a place where merchants were passing through all the time, going north, south, and would buy stuff and sell stuff on the way. But it was also, therefore, a very key place. And in the past, 40 years in the past, spies had been sent in order to spy out the land. And as you probably know, they came back with a bad report, a negative report. And as a result, they believed that and they didn't go into the land and wandered around for 40 years. Now we come to Joshua then, and it says, rather intriguingly in the opening verse, Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim, which is where they were obviously camped, and go and look over the land, especially Jericho. Now, what intrigues me about that is, firstly, there's only two spies this time, and also they were sent secretly. I'm really not too sure how you send spies other than secretly. I don't think you sort of blow a big trumpet in advance and say, here are the spies, here they come. But anyway, they were sent secretly to this place, a bit like sort of secret agents, undercover agents. And they end up in or at the house of someone named Rahab. Why do you think they would go to a house? And why do you think they picked that house, or perhaps they didn't pick that house? Any thoughts on the house or the location where they ended up?
In the One New Man that she was an innkeeper.
Yes, I've got that as a footnote, and we'll come back to whether that's a better version in a minute, yes. Oh, but what you're saying is that basically they're looking for lodgings. They're going there because she was an innkeeper, yeah?
Okay. I mean, mine says a prostitute. Now, if she's a prostitute, there'd be used to men going there, wouldn't there?
Well, yes. So the two choices. But if they're still trying to be secret, I don't think you turn up at the local hostelry and say, can I have a room for the night? But equally, why would they go if she was a prostitute? We'll come back to the idea of being a prostitute in a minute, because we may not quite understand what that means. But yes, the point is, as we will discover later, where exactly was this house? Where did she live? That's in verse 15. Yeah, say it a bit louder. Someone, who it is.
On the walls.
On the walls, yes. Malcolm, did you have that or something else? You're muted though, so we can't tell.
You're still muted, Malcolm.
Still muted, yeah. Perhaps can't hear anyway.
They sent secretly, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they arrived in Jericho secretly, because the king had heard about them.
Well, exactly. That was the point. How had he got hold of this news? Yes. Come back to that in a minute then. But the wall thing, sorry, Caroline, did you say in the wall, on the wall, by the wall? What exactly did you say?
I said it was in the wall.
In the wall. Okay. How would you have a house in the wall? Now, does that make sense?
Well, it does if you live in Biker near Newcastle.
Well, okay.
Indeed, indeed.
What might have been happening here, though?
Well, it clearly had a window, didn't it, to the outside?
Yeah. Yes, okay.
Sorry, are they called casement walls? Are they called casements? The walls in a whole load of archaeological digs and so on in Israel seem to have double walls.
Yeah.
Houses were part of the, well, a shorter space, I guess, or they used the space they had. So houses, rather narrow houses, I guess, were part of the wall system.
Exactly. That's why I showed you that picture earlier on, okay? Because I said it was a double wall and there's a gap in between. So one option is that it was built in the gap above the walls, on top of the walls, if it literally is on the walls, it would be on the wall in between them, where you could actually put, maybe for lack of space, certainly, you could build a cross between the two, and you could put houses on the walls, rather than just, you know, break open the wall and put the house in the middle of it. So maybe there's something in all of that. So, the point about secretly, when they get there, it's not that secret, or at least they're soon discovered, because the king of Jericho, why would Jericho have a king?
The land was divided up into several kingdoms in that time. A lot of kingdoms, they would run from the distance you could see from the highest point to the end of that, and then the next kingdom would start.
Oh, I see.
That would be the same kind of, so the where they could see the territory would be their kingdom.
Ah, right. Okay. So I think what I'm going to say fits in with that, but basically these were very mini kingdoms, really. Yes. So he wasn't yes. a big king. It was actually what you called the main guy in your town. Okay.
Yeah, so I was going to say he was like the mayor, yeah.
Yeah, okay. all the major sort of towns, cities and so on, they had someone who they would call the king. So it doesn't mean he was king of the whole land or miles and miles and miles, but he was the one that they would go to and report the fact that there were some of the Israelites who come in. Now remember, they were used to having traders come in all the time. There's lots of people around there coming and going all the time. But at this point, it was sort of less... or more obvious perhaps, that these weren't perhaps just travelling salesmen, but they were Israelites who have come to spy out the land. Now, I think we can say, but without me checking it up, that they knew that the Israelites were in the area. They knew that they were camped some distance away, and therefore they might well have expected that at some point spies would be sent, because that's what you did. Okay? So they were probably really already keeping their eye open for this sort of thing. And so when these two strangers arrived and maybe somehow looked a bit different, or they soon found that they were different, they realised not only that they're Israelites, but they must have come for a particular purpose. And if there's another reason why they went to the house of this innkeeper stroke prostitute stroke, let's just call her Rahab, have done with it for the moment, it was at least on the edge, and it might have enabled them to make a quick escape. And of course, we don't know whether they've been spending time in Jericho and then went to this house, or they've been snooping around for a while and then decided we'll go in here. We'll come to the time of day in a minute. But maybe they looked a bit different. Maybe the way they spoke was a bit different. But they would be aware that Israelites were in the area. John or Rose?
Yeah, it's kind of odd that they went into the town at all.
Yeah.
They thought they would have skirted round about it.
Yeah.
And said, well, a whole load of folk living in here or whatever else.
And yeah.
It's kind of a bit odd.
Yeah.
Although, on the other hand, they might have thought, well, we need to see what these folk are like. I don't know.
Well, they've been told to go look over the land, especially Jericho. But of course, look over might well mean just, sneak around the outside, see what you can pick up rather than go right into it. It may not have been the best tactics.
Karen's anyway, got her hand up.
All right, thank you. Yeah.
I was just going to say, if you like, going back to the theme of last week, the well would have been inside the walls. And of course, it's very hot, very dry.
Right.
It probably just went for water.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And Pat?
There's the plains of Jericho. I'm not sure if Jericho's on the plains or not. So probably... if they were only on the plains, they would be seen much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite possibly, yeah. Okay. Anyway, we come to the main part of the story where the king sends the message to Rahab, bring these men out because they've come to spy out the whole land. And he doesn't say what he's going to do to them. I mean, you might read it as, oh, bring these men out because we want to entertain them, want to look after them. We're very happy to see them and so on. You don't quite get that impression, though. And at this point, of course, Rahab lies. She starts to tell lies. So we've got to come to terms with that. This is one of the classic cases in which lying in the Bible seems to be a good thing. What do we make of that? In this case in particular, perhaps, or anything about the fact that she is prepared to at least deflect the situation by a lack of truth. Let's put it like that, shall we? We'll be happy with that. Do we think that was a good thing for her to do under these circumstances? We just take it as part of the story. That's it. Not, let's move on. That's what happened. We're not going to pass judgment on it. We're not going to make moral points. We're just going to say, okay, that's what she did. You all seem fine with that then. Okay. No further comment. All right.
It would have been wise to of her to, you know, tell a little white lie, if you like, that's kept them safe. Clearly she felt she was on a, you know, onto something that was on the Lord's side and to keep yes. them covered. And she probably was quite used to, in her profession, she probably told the odd.
Oh, okay, yes.
Every now and again.
Okay. And yeah, so obviously as the story develops, because this thing's coming up in the story, which we're taking it, you know, verse by verse, we're going to find out later, but it might become a bit more obvious why she does this later on. But at this point, she's just basically hiding them and tells this fib, which means that the men go shooting off in order to try and catch up with them because it's now dusk. So these men have got to make a decision whether to get out and chase them before the gates are closed. So they didn't have time, therefore, to search the house and go any further on this. They would have to set off after them before the gates were shut for the night. And it tells us...
Verse 9 gives the lie to the situation of Rahab.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what I say. When we come to that, we will... We'll understand a bit more about why she may well have done this, and we'll work out a bit more whether she really was an innkeeper or a prostitute. We may not get to the final answer, but it might all help in that. But meanwhile, she's hidden them on the roof under the stalks of flax. Now, who can explain lots of interesting things about flax? Anyone know anything about flax?
They use it for making linen or for making parchment?
Yes, linen. Yes. That was a question, was it, rather than telling us? That, okay. Yeah. Well, definitely linen, I'm aware of. Our gardener, viticulturalist, or whatever, John, Rose.
Okay.
He's got the book ready. Okay, that's the book ready. Go on, tell us all about it. I'll provide the pictures.
It's, you supply the pictures, yeah. This guy said it was common to practice to grow the plants until they were fully ripe. This is flax. And then they were pulled up whole and laid out to dry. This was probably what was happening on the flat roof of Rahab's house when Joshua's spies arrived. I found difficulty as a boy in understanding how the spies could be hidden on what I thought must be a very thin matting of flax on the roof. But of course, if Rahab was drying a fair acreage of flax from her plot of land, which may well have lain just outside the city, then the flax which was laid out to dry on her roof could easily be 3 or 4 foot thick, and the spies could have hidden in this without difficulty at all.
Yeah, a bit like sort of haystack or pile of hay in the barn sort of thing. Okay, well, let me come back to this and see if I can get this going a bit better. So we've had the walls. So that is what flax looks like in terms of its flowers. They can be blue, they can be white. and the seeds of them are ground up to make either, well, meal, which is a sort of, well, what is it? It's a food stuff, isn't it, basically, like flour, I suppose, or even more into oil. If you've heard of linseed oil, and if you're a batsman, a cricketer, then you will have heard of linseed oil, well, in the old days anyway, that comes from the seeds of the flax. So it has a food element to it, an oil element, so it's very nutritional as well. But the fibres are the other thing, and the fibres are very tough. And so the next picture, I think I've just got it. This is sort of a sort of close up of it, and I think I've got. Let me come back to that in a minute. But that's the seeds that come from it. You get those seeds, which I've been mentioning. You can grind them up and turn them into something useful. But also you can take the fibre of them, which is actually the fibre. The tough bit is embedded between the outer layer of the stalk and the central woody tissue. And it's very high in cellulose. So the first thing you do is you place all your flax stalks in water or allow dew to settle on them, but they have to be soaked. And then the outer bit is removed and dried, hence they're on the roof. So they stay up on the roof for a long time after they've been soaked. And then you can beat them up a bit more to separate the fibre from the woody part. So there's a complicated process going on in order to produce the fibre, which then can, I suppose, be turned into linen. But it's also, yes, the linen is made from the beaten fibres, which is a very comfortable fabric in hot weather, very useful today. But it was also used for making curtains, veils, garment in the Bible, the garments of the high priest, and so on. Samuel wore linen ephod. When David danced before the Lord, he was wearing only something linen. And the linen that Jesus' body would be wrapped up in would also come from flax. And in fact, where it says, I think it must be in Revelation, that fine linen represents the righteousness of the saints. So we are being covered in fine linen by the righteousness that Jesus gives us. So people can make all sorts of interesting stories about them being covered with the means of making the linen, which is the righteousness, and so on. And this fibre, although it looks a bit sort of tatty here, it can be very nice, and it's compared to blonde hair. So if you've heard of the term flaxen hair, flaxen hair refers to the type of fibre that comes out from the flax plant. So very useful, and certainly there'll be good reason why they would be up, all the stalks would be up there on the roof. They'd have been soaked and then going to be dried out so that they can sort of be stripped and the various bits of that become useful for what they were going to do. Now, verse 8 onwards, and as someone has already said, verse 9, this is really why she lied then. And it's a fascinating statement she makes. She's saying to them, verse 9, I know that the Lord has given this land to you, our land, where we are now. I know the Lord has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us. So all of us that live in this country, and I don't know how far away she means, but certainly Jericho and surrounding, are melting in fear because of you. Basically, their hearts were, their hearts sank, we might say, but they were in great fear and dread. I know the Lord has given this land to you. That's an amazing statement. And they were full of fear. Verse 10 explains why. We have heard of what the Lord has done. They had heard great things. Now, what had they heard of in verse 10? What in particular does it say there they'd heard of?
Karen?
Yeah, we've got Karen, yeah.
In mine it says the dried up the water of the Reed Sea, yeah, for you when you came out of Egypt.
Right, so let's just hold that there.
Was the, what we call the parting of the
yeah
of the Red Sea. Yeah.
But basically the Exodus, yes?
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
40 years.
40 years.
Yeah,
so actually, this is based upon something that had happened 40 years ago. How had they heard about that anyway in Jericho? How had they come to hear about that?
Trade routes.
I missed that bit, someone.
The trade route?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Because the traders came and passed on. They would be telling stories of what they'd heard and what others had heard and so on. This obviously was such a momentous event that people were telling this story all the way round. And so when suddenly the Israelites were very near, this made a big difference. This really mattered. It also says, of other things, when you came out of Egypt, we already know what you've been doing to those on the east of the Jordan. You've already completely destroyed Sihon and Og, two kings of the Amorites. And so our hearts are already sinking. And then another extraordinary statement, for the Lord your God is God in heaven above. Now, remember in those days that everybody had their own gods. There was never any question of, do you believe in God or not? It was a matter of, yeah, of course we do. This is what we believe in. So you were very sort of parochial in your understanding of your God, but also very happy that other people had their own gods as well. So suddenly to say, no, the Lord your God, obviously Yahweh, but just the Lord your God, is actually the God in heaven above and on the earth below. He is really, really special. It sounds like he is the God above all. Otherwise, these things couldn't have happened. Now, I'm going to just pause there. Let's think this through. Does this say anything to you? Anything about us? Does it say anything at all to really get hold of here? It's the heart of the story, really.
Holy Spirit revelation.
Yes. Yes, is that it as well? How does God really get known then?
Reputation.
And... yeah, and how does he get a reputation?
Doing great exploits.
Exactly, through his mighty works. In other words, God gets known because of what he does and because it becomes apparent that this can only really be God, the Lord of heaven and earth. You might say mighty miracles, but just, you know, his mighty works. It's not about a creed. It's not about philosophical ideas. In this case, it is because of what he had done. This is obviously not just any God. So in our, also in our day of multi-gods, and I don't just mean multi-faith, but I mean, you know, the gods of sport and business and so on and so on. What we really need is our God to get a reputation. And it actually says somewhere, ooh, I can't remember where, Deuteronomy or something, about, I can't remember whether it's talking to Moses or whatever, but God made a name for himself by rescuing Israel out of Egypt. It's a lovely phrase. God made a name for himself. And that name, of course, was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, he became known. Yes, he got a reputation. His reputation was spread abroad. Wow, look at what this God has done. This must be special, and so on.
People would have been talking about the things that have been happening.
Yes, yes, it all spread. Now, that would be why they were fearful. But in her case, she went beyond fear into what, do you think? She didn't just... frightened, but she went from fear into
awe.
Awe, yes, and then on further from that.
Faith.
Into a faith.
Faith, yes.
She believes he's the Lord of all.
Yes, this is how she came to faith, effectively. And faith, of course, isn't just a creed. Faith is action. Faith is acting upon what you believe. So she's now prepared to commit her whole life to this. Okay, so from verse 12 onwards, having gone through this confession of how she came to understand who God was through what he had done and the impact it made upon everyone, she says, please swear to me by the Lord. Again, you know, she's already in some way, we might say entering into a relationship with him, that you show kindness to my family because I've shown kindness to me. And that's when it's all set up, this plan to give me a sign that you'll spare not just me, the lives of my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, all who belong to them. In other words, all my sisters and my cousins and my aunts, you know, the whole caboodle, not just me, all of these people, there's someone missing. Who doesn't she say?
Husband.
No husband, and therefore children. So no husband, because?
She's a prostitute.
Yes, that's the biggest clue that maybe she might have been an innkeeper that was single, but she may well have been a prostitute. Now, the other thing that is a possibility is because she has got a father, a mother, brothers and sisters who could look after her without a husband, which, you know, she would have menfolk around and so on, she wouldn't have had to become a prostitute for the purposes of earning money, earning a living or whatever, or she wasn't destitute, she wasn't an outcast or anything like that. So there's the suggestion, and I can't say one way or the other, that she was what would eventually be called a cult prostitute. She was given over to that way of life, probably by her family, within the temple pagan scenario of the city at that point.
Yeah.
In other words, it was her, her honour almost, or at least the family would see it like that, to say, right, our daughter here, our sister and so on, she's one of these temple prostitutes, whatever. Now, I think that's an interesting suggestion. I don't know if anyone knows more about that or can make a comment that might make sense in terms of pros and cons and all that. But maybe that's why she had a position on the wall where she did. Perhaps that's why she was doing that sort of thing. But in which case, she seems to be desperate to get out of this. Okay. Obviously, she basically wants to leave this life behind and go with the Israelites now. She has had enough of this, particularly if, you like, she'd been put into this position by the father and had no choice, and therefore she would never have a husband and never have children. And so she's actually thinking, this is my way out into a new life, because one day I want a family. That might be all part of what's going on here. But she wants to take all her family with her as well. She wants them spared. Okay, John, Rose.
Yeah, it strikes me that actually God might have been gracious and made her barren up to this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
because prostitutes do get children. So it's... So I just wonder if he was gracious and made her barren because she's in the genealogy of Jesus, and therefore
he must have had kids. Well, of course, yes. We'll come to that, but yes, that would be an interesting point when we pick that up. Yes, I mean, I don't know what the pagan practices of Jericho were like, and I wonder if in some cases, if the prostitutes got pregnant, then the children were sacrificed anyway. Might be part of it. We know that happens in various places.
Yeah, or aborted.
Yeah, yes. There's a note in the One New Man at the bottom where it says, some say Rahab was an innkeeper, others that harlot is a metaphor for her being an idolater.
Yeah. Okay, well, yeah. I don't know enough about the word to comment either way. I'm just trying to build a picture on that. Malcolm?
It's just occurring to me that perhaps because her father would have put her into this trade, that the trade of prostitute was considered an honourable one in those days.
Of that kind, yes. As opposed to being someone who is doing it to just earn money, if you like, a sort of grubby little backstreet thing. So, yeah. But if she's happy to leave that all behind because she's seen something better, then that does make a good point on all this. Anyway, she says in verse 12, let's have Caroline.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on what Christine said, because I I understand that there's always very much a link between idolatry and immorality in the Bible. Mm.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And in verse 12, she asks them to swear to me by the Lord. Now, I can do a bit of word stuff here for you. In Hebrew, to swear, to take an oath, is Shabbat, which is very similar to Shabbat, which is seven, and also, of course, Shabbat. So, in fact, the Hebrew to swear is to seven yourself. Sounds weird, isn't it? But it's based upon the number seven. So to swear is to seven yourself. Any idea why that's linked? Well, the only sort of sensible answer on that is that you made a sevenfold oath. In other words, you repeated it seven times.
Oh, right.
And seven being the number that it was, you really made sure you were swearing this by repeating it seven times. That would give a link between the idea of the Shabbat and the Shabbat of that. And that you will show kindness. That's the word hesed, which we all know meaning so much more, to do with mercy, pity, grace, favour, and so on. So she said, I've shown Hesed, please show that to me. Hmm. Yeah, John and Rose.
That helps explain the name of the town Beersheba, where they can't seem to make up their mind. Does it mean the well of the oath or the well of the seven?
Yeah, so it is.
Both.
Yeah, it's all based upon the same sort of thing, yeah. Well, I suppose, firstly, there was a well there, and then they probably made an oath there as well. So, you know, as always in Hebrew, you get the best of both worlds, don't you? You always say it's both of them.
I think they threw in seven sheep, too.
Oh, yes. Yes. Anyway, this oath, this pledge is set up. The men reply, yeah, our lives for your lives and so on. Just make sure that you... there's three things coming up that they have to do. We'll come back to that in a minute, though. Let's come to the rope bit, the cords. So if this house is part of the wall, on the wall or somehow, it said it does make it easy to escape from through the window. And because they'll be high up, if they were on the top of the wall or between the walls high up, so you need some way of letting them out of the down out of the outer wall. So there is this rope or cord. And the word cord, or rope if you like, is tikva. Tikva. Does that remind you of anything?
Yeah.
Hope.
Hope, yes, as in hatikva, the hope, and so on. So actually the word, we tend to know tikva means hope, but it also means cord or rope, and it also means therefore the thing longed for. It's used a lot in scripture. It also comes from kavar, meaning to wait for, to look for, to expect, to collect and bind together. So it's all linked in by the fact that this cord or rope was made of twisted strands of, oh, I wonder what, flax, I imagine. So that makes it really, really strong. And the reason, of course, you bind several strands together in anything really, is that you're not then at the mercy of the weakest strand because there's others to support it. So it's less likely to break or collapse on you. And if you put together several strands, when twisted together in that sort of way, it takes a huge, huge load. It really is far more than the sum of its parts. But anyway, there's lots of use of the word tikva to mean usually hope, expectation, something longed for, and so on. But it's all based upon kavar, where something is bound together to make it useful. So it was both practical in that it enabled them to get out, but also, of course, it remained a sign of hope for her. It symbolized what she was waiting for, looking for, expecting, and what they would look for when they returned. Now, it's going to be eventually scarlet. Where's it? It's got, yes, verse 18. you have tied this scarlet cord in the window. Anyone want to tell us about why it's scarlet? Yes, John and Rose.
Well, I didn't want to tell you why it's scarlet, but I did want to say is, I wonder why these guys brought a scarlet rope with them, or cord, or a piece of string, or whatever it was. Because it, in my version, which is the VW, it says, unless when we come into the land, you bind this cord of scarlet thread in the window, through which you have let us down. So it kind of suggests to me that actually they supplied the scarlet cord, not Rahab.
Oh, you think?
Yeah.
I've never thought of it like that.
No.
Because I would, well, hang on, because, I mean,
yeah, just,
when they're talking to her in verse 17 onwards, she's already tied the scarlet cord in the window and they have been let down. So I don't know whether almost now they're sort of shouting back up to her at that point, but I would never thought that they brought it. I assumed that because she had flax handy as well, that they would have lots of ropes and cords like this.
My verse 17 doesn't suggest that it's her rope cord.
No, well it doesn't say it doesn't say whose it is. I just assumed it would be part of the household rather than something that they brought in with them. But yeah. What you're suggesting is they maybe came ready to be able to.
Which is strange, unusual in itself.
Yeah, but it's probably part of the standard kit that spies took around in those days.
Oh, right, yeah.
Provided by Q Branch for purposes of escape, yes. Yeah, so
wouldn't that rather blow their cover if they were found with it, though, at some point that, you know, you are a spy, you've got this red cord on you. I've heard it said that it was, if you like, part and parcel of a lady of the knight's armoury. She would hang it out the window when she was engaged.
Yes, okay.
And then take it in when she was vacant, if you know what I mean.
I do, yes. So yes. That, I've heard the phrase red light district. Obviously don't know what it's about, but I've heard something similar, yes. That might be part of
red light bulb, yeah.
Yes, okay, Caroline?
It's not the same rope, though, is it? That they, to let them down on a rope the first time, but then they said when they come back to hang the scarlet cord.
Same rope, it says to me.
I know what you're saying. So you're saying it's a different word, verse 15, she let them down by a rope. Okay, but in verse 18, although it's now called a scarlet cord, it is through which you've let us down.
Yeah.
So I can only assume they are the same. I mean, is the word different in the Hebrew, can we say, in verse 15? I've said it's tikva can mean cord, it can mean rope. And I assume that in the Hebrew, there's no difference.
In the study Bible I have, it does say they are different words.
Oh, okay. But it doesn't say what they are or which one is tikva and tom.
But I can look.
Okay. Well, I'm basing it on the fact that she let them down by rope. Mm. And then it says in verse 18, you have tied this in the window through... Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I'm getting it. Oh, it's being tied in the window through which you have let us down. Right, the let us down bit is the window. Ah, I'm beginning to think now that you're right. We've got two separate things.
Yeah.
So maybe they brought the scarlet cord, she provides the rope, she lets them down, and before they're let down, they hand her the scarlet cord and say, use this for our pledge. Right. Mm. Well. Thank you, everyone. Malcolm?
CJB says in verse 18, you tie this piece of scarlet cord in the window you let us down from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gather together your house, your past, and so on.
Yes. That's better. Yeah. And I just haven't read that carefully enough in the past then. So lest we enter the land, you have tied. Yeah, tied the scarlet cord in the window through which you let it down. It doesn't mean that they let her down on the scarlet cord. Yeah.
I always put it by the.
But that would be a better sign or something that would be there, because it didn't have to be big and it wouldn't be dangling out the window necessarily all the time. It's just something they could see. After all that, I think I had a question about 5 minutes ago on why was it scarlet, or any further thing about being scarlet. It was dyed scarlet, yes?
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you've heard, and certainly from me and elsewhere, about the blue dye and the purple dye that was used for royalty and so on. Well, the scarlet dye is something very similar. It would be very rare, very costly, and it would also come from a very tiny little insect, a worm called the Coccus ilicus. I will spell that, C-O-C-C-U-S, Coccus ilicus, or ilicis, whatever, I-L-L-I-C-I-S, I-L-L-I-C-I-S. Tiny little worm, the size of a pea, very common in the Middle East. And it has a very interesting story attached to it, if you like, because it's the female who obviously is going to lay eggs. But before she does so, the female finds a tree, usually an oak, it says, but it could just be a tree, and attaches herself to it, and then somehow covers herself with a hard protective shell. And she's attached now, stuck to this. She excretes the stuff that becomes the hard protective shell. Then she lays her eggs under the cover of all this. And she's so firmly attached that if anyone came along at that point and pulled it off, she would die. But she's prepared to die to protect her eggs, basically. And then when the eggs hatch, the first thing they do is they feed off the body of the mother, killing her. So she really is sacrificing herself, because she's allowing her young to take their first food by eating her. But before she dies, in that process of being killed by her children, she excretes a scarlet dye and therefore covers that area, and her young as well will get stained by that. But you can actually get this sort of scarlet colouring or dye if you're there at the right time, at the moment she's excreting it, as she's basically dying. And in fact, you can also scrape it off. I'm sorry, it's a bit gruesome, but it's fascinating in some way. But you can then scrape the whole thing off the tree, what's rest of her body and the shell and everything that's now scarlet in colour, and ground it up and use it then as the dye. You can extract the colouring from that. You can also turn it into a medicine and so on. How long does all that take? 3 days. 3 days. That's how long it takes for her to die and for the scarlet dye to be produced and so on. If you leave it to the fourth day, it doesn't happen anymore. It turns into a white wax. You can use it for something else, but eventually just flakes off the tree. Now, after all that, fascinating as that is, if ever you want some scarlet dye, just That's go out and phenomenal. Find these little worms.
It's phenomenal.
It is, isn't
it's
it?
It's awesome. Yeah. Amazing.
Well, you're no doubt picking up the analogy in everything I've been saying. And certainly the moment that I
said
3 days, you probably got that. The Hebrew word for worm is tola, T-O-L-A-H, tola, tola, which, as well as meaning worm, can also therefore mean scarlet stuff, or the word crimson. In Psalm 22, I'd like to find the verse for you. Let's see. What does Jesus say? I hope it's in this psalm. We know it's the psalm of the crucifixion. I've got Psalm 22. I haven't got a verse down. Does Jesus, where does he refer to himself as a worm?
It is in Psalm 22.
I am a worm and no man. I will.
Verse 6.
Thank you. Yes. But I am a worm and not a man. And at this point, he uses the word tola, or the psalmist does, the word tola, which is not the same word as the garden worm, which is the rima. It is the self-sacrificing worm or the crimson worm. Okay, so, but oh, I am a crimson worm, or I am the self-sacrificing worm. In other words, not the ordinary garden, common and garden worm. Mm,
that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, so he's using this idea of the little worm that climbs into the, or attaches to the oak tree, dies for the sake of its children and stains the tree red for 3 days.
It's on a tree.
Yeah. On a tree, yeah.
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 Yeah. There we go. And I've lost Joshua. Anyway.
In there somewhere.
Back to our story.
Can I add here, Paul?
Hello.
I looked up rope and cord, and they are two different words. They're two different Strong's numbers. One is a twisted rope, one is a cord or a thread.
So do you know which is which? Is the tikva the original rope then, the twisted one?
I wrote down the numbers.
Oh, okay.
Well, but I didn't write down the Hebrew.
Okay.
I
mean, in some ways...
Well, I would think the rope would have to be the tikva because it said, sorry, the verse 15 one, because it said twisted rope.
Oh, okay.
And the other one just says thread or cord.
But that's interesting because it's almost like the red one that's hanging there, which is her hope, the expectation, the looking for. So there we are. So, anyway, the men say, okay, the oath will not be binding on us unless three things happen. Unless the scarlet cord is there in the window, unless you brought your father, mother, brothers, et cetera, into the house. And if anyone goes out of the house, then we're not responsible for them being killed. And the other condition is if you ever let on what we're doing and so on, then we'll also be released from the oath. So they add these conditions to it. So the idea is that the whole of the family, and if you remember, it was brothers, sisters, all who belong to them, so their other halves and children, they've all got to crowd into what could well be a tiny little house on the walls. And so they all go into lockdown for a while because they're not allowed to go out. Or did they? Maybe. Did they occasionally go out? Because it'd be very strange if she normally went out, particularly to the temple and so on, and suddenly she wasn't doing this. But the other thing is, she's got to persuade them to come in. She wants their lives to be spared, but did they actually want to come in? It's almost like, you know, here's your ark. Are you going to come in or not? And they might think, well, you know, we don't believe like you do. We're not sure this is all the right sort of thing. We haven't met these guys. How do we trust you and all this and so on? Was it difficult to persuade them? And perhaps after a day or two, if they think, well, they're not coming, nothing's happening, we'll just give up and go back outside again then. Almost like those of us are waiting for the Lord's return, it's very tempting to decide, well, we might just sort of give up a little bit for a while or just live a bit differently because, you know, he's a long time coming, all that sort of thing. And also, of course, what would the neighbours think about this strange household now? And if she was indeed she was a prostitute, then that would be affected by all this and so on. It's almost like her old life came to a stop in the interim while she was waiting for her new life to begin. She had committed herself, she'd shown faith, she'd acted upon it, and now she was waiting for her deliverance. In the meantime, there was a test of her faith, her persistence, her endurance. So the point is that they've all got to wait in the house. They're in lockdown if they choose to do so. And the question then is, how long did they have to wait? So have a guess or have a think and come up with a number if you want to. How long was it between the cord in the window and them actually coming back and rescuing or redeem her? Any ideas?
Well, they stayed hid for 3 days.
Right, that's the first bit of the clue. Does anyone want to have a guess before we try and do the maths? I mean, do you think it might have been a week, a couple of weeks, a bit longer? Have you ever thought about that? You know, as you go through the story, oh, I wonder how long it took all this. Okay, well, let's try and piece it all together then. So I think, Malcolm, you just started us off in verse 22. Yeah. So the first thing, that they go and hide in the hills for 3 days to make sure that nobody finds them, basically. Okay. Verse 23, they then go back to the camp, to Joshua, and say everything that happened to them. By the way, they've actually achieved their purpose of being spies, because she said to them, we're all so fearful. We know that you're going to beat us. We're really living here in dread. So they would go back to Joshua and say, this place is ours. Okay, it's going to happen. So they could go back with positive results. So to travel back to the camp, let's put another day on that, shall we? Because they had to go back. And then the next thing that happens in chapter 3 and verse 1, as they were camped, if you remember, at Shittim, and they go to the Jordan and they camp there. So they all have to move camp to the edge of the Jordan. Okay, verse 2, what have we got in chapter 3 and verse 2? Thanks. More time?
3 days.
Another 3 days. And by the way, Shittim is about 12 miles from the edge of the Jordan, so that's why it would take them a good day to move and set up. How many days have we got so far, do you think? Anyone keeping count?
Five.
A bit more, I think. We've had two threes. Yeah, okay, we've had two threes. Well, we could say it's been three, and then one, and then one, and then three. We could actually get eight, if you think about it. 3 days hiding, one them travelling back, one the whole camp moving, and then we've got three more.
Yeah.
Chapter 3, verse 17. After the 3 days, they cross. Where's chapter 3, verse 17? Anyway, they then cross, and the dry ground appears in the middle of the Jordan, and so on. It's going to take another day then for them to undo the camp again where they are at the edge of the Jordan, and everyone move across. And then it says in chapter 4 and verse 19, that they went up from the Jordan, and now they camp at Gilgal. Gilgal. So they've got to set up camp again. Okay. And at this point, they take the 12 stones and they stop and so on. But actually, something else is about to happen. And I can't find the date of this. Somewhere it tells you which date it is. We've got to know. Oh, the 10th day of the first month. Verse
19. Yes. Yeah. So we have to celebrate Passover there.
They're coming up to Passover. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's getting near. But actually, in chapter 5 and verse 2, okay, so in the meantime, all of this, we've got Rahab and family all in the house waiting. In chapter 5 and verse 2, they actually circumcise the Israelites again. See that?
Yeah.
And then in verse 8, what happens next then? They stayed in the camp until they were healed. Yeah? About another 3 days there. Another 3 days to sort of be able to move about again. And now, chapter 5 and verse 10, we've reached the 14th day of Nisan. So we've now hit Passover.
2 weeks later, yeah.
Yeah, so there's another 7 days now of unleavened bread and the celebration of all that. I don't know if you've been counting, but I reckon we've reached about 3 weeks so far.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, they march from Gilgal to Jericho. It's another day. Now, at last, the Israelites are there. They can be seen. So after about 3 weeks of waiting, wondering, are they really going to come back and so on, while they're waiting all there, at last they see them, and they must think, great, tomorrow's the big day. No, it isn't, because there's then 6 days of marching round and round the walls until the final day when it all falls down. So there's another week of them just sitting and waiting. So in the end, I think it's about a month. I think we're heading for about 4 weeks worth from the moment when they leave down the rope to when they come back and the walls collapse. And, you know, during these 6 days when they're all marching around, I think everybody in the city, including Rahab, must be thinking, what on earth are they doing? Why don't they get on with it? Have we trusted in fools here? I mean, am I putting my lot with people here on the basis of, you know, their God is great and mighty? And what are they doing? And how is she able to sort of persuade her family? Well, you know, it's going to happen. Just hang on in there. Stay in the house and so on. And then, of course, eventually it happens. There's the huge noise of the shofar, the collapse of the walls. And at that point, of course, this is an interesting bit. You would expect that her house would come tumbling down. So probably, why would you want to stay in the house if your walls and the whole house is about to come crashing down? But we've reached chapter 6, by the way. We've reached chapter 6 and verse 22. Well, verse 20, the trumpet sounding, the people shouted, and the people gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So they just rushed in and took the city. But it says in verse 22, Joshua said to the two men who spied out the land, go to the prostitute's house and bring her out and all who belong to her in accordance with your oath. So they go in and they bring out the whole family and so on. But there's no mention there of what? What's missing in verses 22 and 23? What would we
expect? It doesn't mention the red thread.
It doesn't mention the thing, does it? So all this business of... Now, they would have seen it while they were marching round. Okay, so that would have been helpful, perhaps. But at this point, if the whole walls are falling down and her house is falling down, it's all gone anyway. But however the practicalities of that work out, and Joshua obviously says to the young men, you better do this because you know them or you've met her. So at this point, the young men go in and bring out Rahab and all the associated people. And then what do they do with them?
Put them outside the camp.
Put them outside the camp. Yeah.
But going back to the wall, I get the impression that the bit of the wall where their house was did mm-hmm. not fall down. They went into the house.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you go to the archaeological dig there,
yeah,
that's sort of obviously where these walls, these pictures of these walls come from. The whole of the wall wasn't actually breached. It wasn't all fall.
Yeah.
Didn't all collapse. It's more that sort of there was a large section of it collapsed, but
right.
not the enough, whole of the wall. All the
enough
way
for them to
Jericho.
Go rushing in and take the city yeah. then. Yeah, okay, yeah. fair enough. I did wonder, but when I just read there, the young men went in and brought out, I thought went into the city, but you're right, because it says, go into the prostitute's house and bring her out. So actually the story does end with them all in the house, and so their bit didn't fall down. So that's, again, part of the miracle of it all, if you like. That yeah. the bit of the wall that didn't collapse was the right bit. Anyway, we've reached her being put effectively outside the camp. This is where, you might know, people were put if they had infectious diseases, but it's also where foreigners were put. If foreigners came along and wanted to attach themselves to Israel and say, yeah, we want to follow your God, we want to be what they call proselytes or people who would be God-fearers, eventually they were called, and things like that. But foreigners who wanted to attach themselves to the people of Israel were always put into a camp outside, or place outside the main camp, I should say, to start with. I suppose it was a way of checking various things, maybe to do with diseases, whether they were genuine. They were just kept apart for a little while, perhaps, I don't know, to educate them in some way and whatever. But, and then I think it says in Leviticus that sacrifices were made for them and they were brought fully then in amongst the people. And that's how it ends in verse 25, when it basically says, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. which is interesting. But she was then brought in properly into amongst the Israelites. That little phrase, she lives amongst the Israelites to this day, must mean at the time in which this book was written, or these, or at least these records, these accounts were being written. So, as always, they weren't being written at the time, but written sometime later, and we don't know exactly when. But it's almost like, if you really want to check this story out, you can go and talk to her. She's still amongst us. She will tell you how it all happened. And then the bit perhaps you've all been waiting for, how it ends in the New Testament, because we leave her at this point, I think. She lives amongst Israelites to this day, and I don't think we hear anything more about her in the Old Testament. But we do know, of course, that her integration into the life of Israel was complete when she married an Israelite. No mention of her marrying in the Old Testament, in Joshua and so on. But we do know who she married. Anyone know his name off the top of their heads without looking it up? Who she married? Pat? You're muted, though.
You muted, Pat.
Was it Nashon?
No.
Was it Obed?
I think so, no. Oh, I see we got Nashon from. Hang on a minute, let me make sure I've got this right. Having said no very quickly there. She married someone called Salmon, I thought. Oh, is he there? Yes, there we are. So we're obviously in the genealogy in Matthew now. Nashon is the father of Salmon. Salmon is the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab.
Which verse are you at?
Five.
Which chapter?
Matthew 1, the genealogy in Matthew. Yeah,
right.
I just double check me here in case I have made a mistake. Have I got this right? That so the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Okay, so Boaz's mother was Rahab, Salmon with his father. So Salmon, perhaps might be a better way of pronouncing it, but sorry. See a word like that, I can't help but say Salmon. Salmon must have married Rahab, and they had Boaz. And Boaz was then the father of Obed. Have we got that right, you think? Yeah? I'm hopeless with genealogy sometimes, okay. But I think that's the way to read that. Yeah. So she does marry, and not only does she marry, she is honoured with a very special son, Boaz, who also, of course, married a Gentile convert, Ruth, and you know that fascinating story. And I wonder if in some way Boaz thinks, okay, I'm going to marry a Gentile convert, Ruth, but that's okay because my mother did the same. I hadn't realized there was such a close sort of genealogical link between Rahab and Ruth, basically through Boaz. And there's one other fascinating little thing about her in James. James chapter 2, verse 25. James, where's James gone? Yes, James. James chapter 2. No, still lost James. I'll get that before me. There we are. Now, in James chapter 2, which is about faith and deeds, and James is trying to tell us, you know, if you haven't got deeds to go with your faith, what's the point of your faith and so on? And he starts off in verse 20. Do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? Okay, here's Abraham. So verse 21, Abraham, and verse 22, Abraham, and verse 23, Abraham, Abraham, Abraham. In verse 25, in the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did? So of all the other people that James could have chosen, okay, it's Abraham and Rahab. Okay. Remarkable that she's included here as the second best example after Abraham himself. And she's commended there for her faith, and her faith that was acted upon in the same sort of way. And of course, the point about the Matthew genealogy is, of course, eventually it's the line of Jesus in all that as well. Well, that's Rahab through Joshua and on into the New Testament. I think we've said just about everything we can about her. Has anything else come to mind? Any thoughts?
Yeah, she's mentioned in Hebrews 11 as well.
Ah, right. Okay. Thank you. Yes, she is. I can see it now in verse 31. But as part of a greater, longer list, of course. So she's there then. I just think it's fascinating in James that he's only going to pick two, and yet he picks her out of it. But yes, thanks. It is there in Hebrews 11, I think, verse 31. And there, she is called prostitute in both Hebrews and James. And there's no footnote in mind saying, well, she might have been an innkeeper. So if the Hebrew might be a bit ambivalent, as it often is, perhaps the Greek is a bit stronger, or a bit clearer, I should have said.
There's a whole chunk in the glossary of the one new man explaining about harlot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Idolater. Yeah.
Okay. Harlot, fornicator, immoral, and common translations of the Greek word porneia.
Well, oh, yeah.
This is the primary meaning of the word. It is used to speak of any idolatry, as in Hosea and John Revelation. Another example is Rahab, not necessarily a harlot, but certainly an idolater in pre-Israeli Jericho. And then verses in Isaiah tie luxurious living to harlotry, putting wealth in its proper perspective, etc., etc., etc. There's quite a bit of it.
So it may not be being used to refer to anything she sort of did like a professional, whether it's keeping an inn or being a prostitute. It was more her her idolatry. But then would that mean if you're not in Israelite in the first place, what kind of idolatry are you displaying? Was she idolatry?
Pagan.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is if pagan is your religion and you're idolatrous to that, you know, was she rebelling against the religion of the place, Jericho?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, by becoming an Israelite or becoming, you know, in their faith, then she was being idolatrous to whatever her upbringing was. But or maybe it's just an Israelite sort of comment upon the fact that she was a normal Jericho pagan sort of person, and therefore that's idolatrous in their sight. Okay. Well,
or it could tie in more strongly through your previous comment about being a temple prostitute.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they would, they would be used as a form of active worship.
Yes.
You know, so, the acts that they partake in would be seen.
Yeah,
as an act of worship by the person that they're taking it with.
Yeah.
So, if you know what I mean.
I do. And therefore, we're saying it is an Israelite or a Hebraic description of her, because she was idolatrous in their eyes by doing what she did, which was normal. And it's almost like, who knows when these stories are written up? It's later. How should we describe her then? Well, if she was that, we'll better call her idolatrous in that sense then. Okay. Okay then. So that's
Paul, can I ask a question that's not actually got anything to do with Rahab, but at the beginning you mentioned Jericho. Did you say that there was a new city built there?
Oh, okay.
The reason I ask is,
and I think I know what you're coming to.
There
is a modern place there. I think Karen will tell me more, but for my time now, I remember there is a place where you go, but then they take you to the ruins next to it, don't they?
Yeah,
they do, but it's all still seen as Jericho. It, And the Jericho that you visit is the oldest.
Yeah.
It is okay. The oldest city in Israel.
Are you going to tell us, Jackie, about the fact that it wasn't meant to be rebuilt at all?
I was going to say that, yes, just looking at verse 26 or so, at the cost of his firstborn son, will you lay its foundations? Otherwise, your children are going to die if you rebuild it. And then in 1 Kings 16, it says, in Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt it.
Yes.
He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn, Abiram. And he set up his gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segun, as the Lord spoke to Joshua.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. There was a prohibition, even a curse, if you like, upon not rebuilding it. Mm. And it, I always say then that that shows how bad things had got in Ahab's time, that they now totally disregarded anything like that. The word of God meant nothing to them. And even when the first half came true, it didn't make him think, I'd better stop. It's a fascinating little detail. And that is all just before Elijah comes on the scene, I think, isn't it? So things have reached rock bottom from that point of view. But what happened then with that rebuilding and how we end up with what we've got today? All I'm saying really is that it's when you go there today, it's not a place where there's only ruins, is there? I think you can have your ice cream there. Well, I think I've had a Coca-Cola in Jericho, something like that.
It's a thriving city, yes. Yeah. Thriving, of course, mainly Arab city.
Yeah.
You know.
Because it's in such a nice strategic place still, isn't it? It's
fact it's within the modern day red line where Jews aren't actually allowed. It's the Jewish authorities that prevent them, but for their own safety's sake, there is a security line around Jericho, and Jews aren't allowed into Jericho. So if they go in under their own steam, they go in at their own risk, and the Israeli soldiers will not enter Jericho to protect them. That's the modern day thing, yeah. So that's just up to date. It's current.
But you would still take tourists there, would you, though? Tourists are allowed in, presumably.
Yes, tourists are allowed in there, Jewish guide can't go in. You have to dump your Jewish guide and then go in with an Arab guide and then pick your Jewish guide up again on the way back out. If you take an Arab guide, mostly you'll go in and you'll just have a lunch break there and it'll be... So you effectively your Jewish guide won't come in. Unless, of course, the Jewish guide is prepared to go against country's advice. Some of them do.
Yes.
And go in regardless.
Thank you.
That's just a bit of trivia.
No, it's very, very important. Okay.
Actually, at the time of Jesus, I remember hearing somewhere that a lot of the priests lived in Jericho. I don't know if that's correct. You know, and in the Good Samaritan story that we discussed last week, it mentioned that the man was on his way from Jerusalem to Jericho, and the priest was going that way, and the Levite were going that way as well.
It's not that far from, is it that far from Jerusalem, is it? It must be a half a day's journey. I mean, then, not now.
Yes, something like that. Yeah, it's a bit uphill to Jerusalem. But, again, you see, you're talking about the access to water.
Yeah.
You know, where there would be water available. You know, that's one of the things that Jericho had got going for it. Because the spring outside is Marah, is, you know, not good, basically. So you have to go in, yeah. So that's what it would have been, going in for the good water.
Anybody else? Any comments or Questions or on anything related? Malcolm, you want to come in here? Malcolm Harding, that is.
You're muted, Malcolm. Malcolm, you must unmute.
I don't think you've got a microphone working, though.
Sound like you're underwater.
Sorry, we can't pick up anything much you're saying at all, I'm afraid. Sorry.
It is a very long uphill drag from Jericho to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
My dad used to tell me about it. He was out there before the war.
Oh, right.
How the Crosley lorries used to grind up the hill, you know.
Yeah, the camels were much better at it.
Malcolm, you could put your question in chat or comment, I guess.
Yeah. If it's brief enough and easy enough to do, then fine, we'll hang on while you do that.
Because Jericho is effectively below sea level, so, it is a long way up.
Yeah, it's a big drop, isn't it? So. Is that where...
And dangerous as well.
Is that where when you're driving down, is that where you pass that sign that says you're now below sea level? Is that
Yes. And Jericho is left along the plain a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
If you've opened your plastic bottle of water, you can find it all squashed when you go down to Jericho.
Right.
If you last opened it up in Jerusalem, then it's all the atmospheric pressure has pushed in on it.
Fascinating. I don't know whether we're getting anything in the chat or not, but
looking busy.
Yeah, something's happening, but I don't know why it hasn't got a working microphone.
That probably said he needs a new laptop, I think.
Okay. Well, we might switch the recording off now or very soon. Not get anywhere else, and. So next week,
where is it? Stop recording.